All right. Today is August 2nd. This is a follow-up interview. This is Roger Eardley Pryor. I'm here speaking with Katrina Baxter, and we are in Philadelphia on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And the last time we met, Katrina, you had just spoken about moving from Ithaca, New York, to back to Philadelphia with you and your daughter and having a new experience here. So bring me up to date from when you moved here to Philly to what you're up to today. And what the city, what kind of things you're up to in the city today.
Right. So when I first moved back to New York, I was being vetted for directorship at one of the farms, the local farms here, Urban Ag Farms here. And that didn't work out. So that was more because that organization itself was sort of, was trying to get themselves together. So they decided to just go like a whole other way from what they originally, like, okay, let's fall back.
But you knew you wanted to do urban farm work when you came back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I specifically knew when I came back to Philadelphia. Well, in Ithaca, I had worked across the gamut in different issues for the black community. And that sort of took me away from what I realized that I wanted when I realized that I wanted to work specifically environmental issues, right? Because, you know, remember, I think I mentioned that earlier, that I sort of figured at some point that land is the basis of all of our ills, right? So so if I'm going to be fighting, like, sort of thinking about all the different things that, you know, I feel like they're wrong, right? All the different injustices in the world, I thought my energy would be best served working through the environment, right? And this was, you know, and this was, I think I mentioned that the last time. If not, then that happened sometime in my early 30s.
Okay.
So when I got sort of wrapped up in so many things in Ithaca, I was like, okay, so that is not what I want to continue to do. I don't want to have my energy spread so thinly across the board because so many issues in our community need to be addressed that I can't fully address one thing, right? So I decided when I came back to Philadelphia that I was just going to work in environmental issues. Like, I'm just going to stay there. And also that I really wanted to work with black organizations. Like, I just, you know, it was a great thing that I was able to do that in Ithaca, and so I wanted to continue that, you know, working with black organizations. It was really challenging to find any, and then that's when I found out that there were really no black or urban ag orgs in Philadelphia, right? Not run by any black folks. And that the urban ag community here was pretty small and siloed, right? So organizations weren't really talking to each other a whole lot across the board. You know, with our nonprofit, it's sort of like, you know, that's our competition for grants, right? And so there's not a lot of impetus to work together organizationally unless the grant requires a collaboration, right? And so I think a lot of us feel like, you know, our organizations, you know, sort of required us to see each other as competition as opposed to, you know, friend as opposed to, like, alliances.
Yeah.
And those of us who work the land understand how very important we are each to each other, right? So, you know, the whole understanding how ecosystems and how ecosystems work and working in that field just gives you a really, you know, present, I guess, understanding of how connected we all are and how important it is for those connections to be there. And so for 2 years when I first got here, I think for a year and a half, I worked in doing parenting classes. So I couldn't find any work in urban ag, mostly because it was siloed and very much folks were hiring people that they didn't know who looked like them. And that was disconcerting for me because I felt like my resume speaks for itself. Like, why am I not getting callbacks? Why am I not? And where are the jobs? Like, where are they posted? Where, you know, how do people even find out? You know, so it was a while.
And this is late 2000s.
Yeah, this is late 2000s. Yeah, 2012. Mm. And so, you know, I volunteered at a whole bunch of farms around community gardens around my area. I got involved with the Peace Park. I got involved with right now it's Brewery Community Garden, Brewerytown Community Garden. At the time, it was Marathon Farms. Those are both in my community, not too far from my house, both of which Marathon Farms was started by a restaurant in North Philly, the restaurant was, you know, downtown, but they, like, got this lease to purchase this land in the middle of the hood, you know, to grow food for their restaurant and, of course, for the community, too. So the interesting part about what I felt about that project was that what we usually look for in community gardens, and this is, you know, after a few years of researching and working nationally with other folks through Ithaca, my work in Ithaca, was that, you know, when white folks come into a community of color and start a garden, there's no buy-in, right? Because those folks didn't say, this is what I want. There's someone else from the outside coming in and telling them, this is what you need. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, across the board, nationally, those programs aren't really well received, and you don't get a lot of community buy-in. So you might have a whole lot of activities happening there, but it's not really, engaged. The community isn't necessarily engaged in those. So that's always been an issue. That has been an ongoing issue within urban agriculture. And so so with Marathon Farms, it was interesting to me because there's a young man, there's a gentleman on the block who totally was like, what is this going on? He lived next door to the farm. So he's like, what is happening? When it started happening, he hang out with them the whole year, the first year they were there, learned everything because he has this ridiculous memory where he can remember everything. Literally learned everything they did in a year, right? And the next year was able to do everything that had never grown before, right? So they were really excited, impressed, and they hired him, which is unusual, right? Because that's not usually how those things go. And then he was taking in, and so by the time I came, I think that was his second year, the end of his first season there. And he was telling me sort of his story. So I was helping him at the farm, at the garden there, and then I learned about the Peace Park, which wasn't too far from that. So I started volunteering there as well. And so I was just doing a lot of volunteers and gardening. And then one day I saw the job for the Law Center, at the time it was the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia, which is PILCOP. And
what is it now, officially?
We changed it to the Law Center so that we took off to Philadelphia. Because people were saying PILCOP instead of PILCOP. But now everyone still calls us PILCOP, so it's just so confusing. Transitions take a while. So when I saw the job, it was interesting because, my thing is I didn't, checking out, I had known a few of the organizations now. I knew about UNI because I had some friends who worked there that I met at conferences nationally. I knew that was a large farm that was organized through a university, so I wasn't absolutely sure that was the way I wanted to go politically, understanding the dynamics between university and community and community collaborations and how challenging those are.
Where is the UNI farm? Is it over in West Philly or
Bartram,
up north?
It's at Bartram Gardens.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They have a huge, beautiful farm in the back of Bartram Garden, and that was started with the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So they were really well resourced, of course, but had a very specific mission that was tied to University of Pennsylvania, not tied to the community, right? So the other job fell through. So I was doing parenting classes, and then I saw this job. And when this job came across, really, I saw Amy Lahr's name. And I had met Amy Lahr Khan, who's the woman that I work with, the attorney that I work with here. She just left, actually. She just left. Moved on to better things. But she and I had met a couple of years ago in a conference in California. I really liked her. She was sweet. She had good politics, right? We were in the conversations that we were having when we were talking about these things in Oakland. And then I met her again. Then we got reacquainted when I first moved back to Philadelphia. There was a conference out here. My friend Malik Keeney from Detroit was in town. And he and I went up to the conference, and she and I had a whole conversation then, too. This was a year before I moved back here, or a couple of months before I moved back. So when I saw the thing, and I remember saying, I'm going to reach out to her when I move here, right? Mm-hmm. I took a card, and I never did, or maybe I did once or twice, and we never really linked up or something like that. And so when I saw the job, I was like, oh, that's for me. That job is for me, I had no idea what a public interest law center was, because who ever heard of a nonprofit law center? Unless you're really, I don't know, I just never heard of that. So it was okay, I don't know really what this is, but I know that I respect her politics, and I know that that job will allow me to work across gardens across the city, right? I won't have to be just sort of loyal to one organization. I'll be able to work with all these different organizations and help them in these ways. And that was, for me, really advantageous.
When did that position open up?
And that was in the fall of 2014.
Awesome.
Yeah.
When you talk about the politics, uh-huh. What does that mean? I've seen you speak before about this relationship when you work the land that creates both prosperity and encourages democracy. Uh-huh. What are the politics that you're interested in doing this sort of land movement?
Right. Well, I think for me, when I was speaking about, I guess, Amy Lahr specifically, when I think about politics of white folks, right? So, for me, and actually, I think about it across the board. But when I think about it in relation to who I'm going to work with and who I'm going to, throw down with, right, mm-hmm. in the movement, it's like movement terms, who I'm going to throw down with, and I need to know what are your personal politics, what are you moving politically, and where do you stand politically when it comes to race and economics, right? Racial justice and economic justice, right? So racial justice, a lot of people will have an understanding of, right? So, and I think when I say politics, an understanding of the real issues behind the situation, right? So what do you understand about the racial politics, you know, the racial situation for black folks and people of color in this, and where you stand in that, right, is really important to me. So if you don't have, you know, people that say they're, you know, I'm very much all about social justice, but you don't have a racial politic, right? You don't have a racial analysis, right? And then you may have, you know, then that's challenging. That's a problematic for me, right? So I don't want to be people who just want to do good, right, without really understanding the issues behind the systemic oppressions that affect us, right? Mm-hmm. So really, when I say politics, I'm saying people's understanding of the systemic ways that other folks are affected through our society, right? Mm-hmm. And so I understand that we all have, you know, there's a continuum. You know, some people are here and some people are here. If you look at it as like a metronome, so I choose to work with people who are a little bit more understanding and knowledgeable on their politic around race, right? Yeah. And gender, and that's really important to me. So Amy Laura, in that sense, had really good politics around race and gender. So she's someone I could work with, because then I don't have to be constantly explaining why these things are important, right? So that, because that's what happens if you're working with people who don't have a politic, then it's a constant education, right? Mm-hmm. Of getting people up to speed and understanding why we fight for these things and why these things are happening to our communities, and also also sometimes convincing them that these things are actually happening. Because a lot of people refuse to understand that this is our reality as black folks on this planet. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean. And so when I saw the job, Amy Laura, it was there at the interview, and I just was like, this is my job. And usually that's how I get things, you know, I'm like, okay, I know this is for me. So, you know, I knew it was for me, but, you know, I had no idea what this whole thing was. It was my first time applying specifically as an organizer, right? Because I had said before that I didn't really understand, you know, I just do what needed to be done in my community. People are like, oh, you're an organizer. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. So now I was like, you know, understanding that is my role, right? And knowing what now at that time, understanding what an organizer was, it's like, oh yeah, I can do that. I do that all day. Mm-hmm. So I started here, which was awesome. And you know, it allowed me to really, I think, in my role, because it's a law center, and because of Amy Laura's work before I got here, she's very respected in the urban ag community, because she has been championing like the causes of urban agriculture since she got into this role more than anyone before her, right? And across the nation, she's like the only full-time lawyer working in these type of issues in the country, right? Wow. So she, you know, what she did here in Philadelphia was just like phenomenal. And so I was thankful to be a part of, you know, like this machine that was just, you know, just getting started. And
can you tell me a little bit? So you mentioned earlier that you saw land as kind of the focal point for that brings together all these issues that are about justice, right, that are about the black community, that are about economic issues, that are about gender inequality, right, and the systemic forces that encourage continued oppression of that. Mm-hmm. How does that all come back together for you in terms of agriculture, in urban agriculture? Why is that the connection point?
Right. Well, I think that for me, I think it first stemmed from, like, when I think about the history of the world, right? A lot of it we don't know, right? We just have this European history of this European understanding of what, you know, civilization is, quote unquote. And so, you know, if you look at the beginning of European history, a lot of what they, you know, all they talk about is fiefdoms and sort of, you know, their whole impetus for movement, their migration, was based on them needing land, right? Not being able to subsidize, you know, themselves in the place where they were, so looking to other places to get the thing. And so that sort of, so when you look at that, that's like everything stems from, right, this desire to have something that is not yours, which is the land, because the land is what provides you with everything that you need. Right, and if you have land that is barren, then you don't have everything that you need. So land, for me, understanding that, right, that everything comes from the land, means that the land is most important, right? And so that when I think about the work that we do here in the cities with regards to urban agriculture and the act of taking over vacant lots and repurposing them for the community, you know, for community purpose, is taking back, right, control, right, taking back power, right, taking back this ability to sustain ourselves through the land. even though it, you know, it's on a small, you know, if you want to just look at it as like it's just growing food. But for me, I'm looking at it in a very larger sense of power, right? Because understanding that that is what has guided this whole process all along, right? People's desire to have that land so that they can have what they need. And so that's sort of where that connects for me.
That's beautiful. Because the last time we spoke, you spoke a lot about your environmental awakening being also a spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just wondering how these all of these things mm-hmm. collide together in this yeah. one sort of environmental frame mm-hmm. Is really, I think that helps. It helps me understand.
Yeah.
It.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's helped. So one of the things I wanted to just make this really clear that when my daughter, so when we first moved here, the first year we were here, my daughter and I were driving in the car and we were having this conversation, and she says to me, "Mom, you know, y'all raised us. She says, "Y'all raised us." I think about those folks out there mm-hmm. who raised us alternatively, right? You know, to understand these systems and understand, how unjust the system is. She's, you know, grew up in this with this very light alternative, like not what the average person or average family is, you know, discussing at their dinner table or things that we discussed about. And she's like, "But what are we supposed to do with that?" You know, so she was like, so when I graduate from college, I'm going to college, when I graduate from college, what am I supposed to do? Knowing the system as it is, how could I rightfully go into this workforce, right? And expect to contribute in these ways in the system that we're not down with. And that was like a moment for me that I hold that as my charge, right? For my child to create something for the future. And so since that day forward, I've been working towards building a future for my child, right? So mm-hmm. where does she go when she comes out of school is really important to me. Where do her friends go? What are the other opportunities that our young people will have, you know, that are not embedding them in a system that is against them? Mm-hmm. And so that was what's been guiding me since she was in ninth grade. So this work started here, and right when I took the job was actually when the land bank law got passed.
The land bank law is
a huge deal here in Philadelphia because it will allow the city to take over, to lump private property into one parcel, right? So private and public property. So public property and private property has completely, there's two different ways to get access to if I have my garden, my garden's on four different lots. Those four lots could have four different owners, and those four different owners will have four different processes in order for me to get ownership of that. And that is like the most confusing thing in the world for people. So most of the gardens in the city are illegal because of this, right? Most of us don't have licenses or leases to be on the land. We don't own the land. We just utilize the land in our space. And if we wanted to own the land, it would be really challenging because you have all these different processes. And if you don't know the right people, you wouldn't know how to do the thing. So the land bank was designed to create a process within the city that could lump those things together for a garden, for a developer, for community benefit. And take, if it's a privately owned lot that is tax delinquent, then it can take that into public inventory and group that together and sell that parcel or lease that parcel to a community organization. It's very specific. The language was very specific around development specific to the community, right? Development that would be helpful to the community. So it's not for big developers that are just coming in to put up condos, right? It's very much about low-income housing or mixed-income housing. Not a whole lot for low-income housing, unfortunately. Mixed income housing, you know, community, elderly housing, those type of things, and gardening. And so there was a coalition that formed before I started here called Healthy Foods Green Spaces, and it was a coalition of urban ag enthusiasts and who came together to help make that put very specific language into the land bank during the process of them creating and writing out the law. And so it was an awesome effort. Mostly institutional. The coalition was mostly institutional. They fought initially. They came together around some zoning laws that they were fighting, and then they stayed coalesced to fight to change and help work with the land bank legislation. And so that had just been passed that December, and it was all these wonderful things, you know, that were supposed to be happening because of the land bank. It was going to make it easier for all of us. And so when I came aboard, my job was one of my jobs was to organize, continue to organize this coalition. But because the land bank had been passed, as the nature of coalitions, you sort of coalesce for a thing, and the thing was over. So most of those institutions didn't come back to the table. And so who was left at the table was like folks who were really invested in working in urban ag and moving forward policy in very specific ways. And so then we talked, Amy Laura and I, about what we really want the coalition to be. And we, you know, said that it should be community informed. It should be community folks at the table. There should be gardeners in this coalition, not just institutions. And then that's what I started to work towards, right? Getting gardeners at the table for the coalition. You know, let's bring some actual people who are on the ground doing the work into this thing. And then while I was doing that work, I realized that actually also I want people to come to the table with their personal politics, not their organizational politics. So that, you know, with coalition, it's challenging because institutions want to be aligned with a coalition, right? Yeah. For them, it looks good. But for us as employees, that's really challenging because a lot of times our politics don't align with that organization. So
how do you create a coalition that lets that space grow?
Right, you make it known in the beginning, like you say that, right? You name the thing. And so I was very clear with folks when I invited them out to meetings that, you know, I want you to come with your personal politics. I'm not asking you to be a part of this because you work at food, you know, at Food First. I'm not asking you here because you work at Union. I'm asking you here because you're a grower, right? I'm asking you here because you care about these issues. And so people were down with that. You know, the folks who came were like, oh yeah, we totally need this. And the folks who came were like, oh yeah, because we didn't, because it was all white before. There was two people of color in the whole coalition. Maybe three people of color in the coalition. And so, you know, now, you know, I was engaging people of color, growers of color around the city, inviting them out to the meetings. They were excited to be connected to other growers of color because a lot of times we feel isolated in the work that we're doing, not knowing that all these other folks are out there doing this work too. And even the folks who were of, there are few folks of, who were of color working in organizations were like, they needed respite as well, right? Away from the organizations that were completely white and not understanding the issues within their communities and still trying to push forward a mission, right? And so this was, from what folks tell me, that it was a place of respite where we can come together and like talk about these issues and support each other in different ways. And also break the silos, right? So we were like really keen on the sense that, you know what, we would work better together. You know, even though our organizations have been trying to keep us pitted against each other, this actually works better when we support each other. And that's what we did, and that's what we continue to do. And we changed our name to Soil Generation within a year. Yeah, so that first year of us being sort of coalesced and growing the coalition, we decided that we wanted to be another name. Most of us weren't a part of creating that first name, and we were completely different, right? We looked completely different than that did. So we had this dynamic meeting where we chose our name in like 20 minutes. It was awesome.
It's a great name.
It's a great name, right? And the process was awesome too. When we think of it, we talk about it. All of us are like, yo, it's the best process ever. And it was right. It just felt right when it locked in. It was like, okay, yeah, that's who we are. And so we moved forward as Soil Generation. And then a year later, we decided that we would name the fact that we were Black-led. Because I, you know, being the co-organizer of the thing, we practice shared leadership. And they recognize that because this is voluntarily run, I'm pretty much the only one getting paid to do the thing. So I'm leading and moving the organization in certain ways based on the conversations that we have within the group and that I have with people within the group individually. So that for me is what I considered shared leadership at the time and also building up folks within the coalition to feel like they can take ownership of the thing, right? Mm-hmm. So we decided to name it Black-led. It was very important for us to name it Black-led, and a lot of the white folks in the group were very adamant about that as well because they feel like they understand their liberation is tied up in Black liberation. So when Black people get free, everyone gets free. Mm-hmm. And that's because we're at the bottom of the, you know, there's a whole theory behind why, right?
Yeah.
Like the whole theory of the press thing. And so the folks who are working within the coalition understand that. So it's multinational, mostly multiracial, purposefully, right? So that we can make sure that all the voices are heard. It's still not as POC as I would like it to be. Like, we need more Latino representation there. We need more, you know, and also recognizing that they also have Latinos in Philadelphia have a large network within themselves, right? In their communities with growing food. So I don't feel a need for them to be there unless it's a need for them. You know what I mean? Like, if you feel like you need to be connected with this larger movement of, then do so. You know, we have Asian folks who are part of the group, which is awesome. And Black folks who are part of the group, and then white folks who have been really growing with us in this process and understanding and releasing their privilege, right, in certain ways, and then using their privilege in certain ways to move things forward. And that brings us up to what I was talking about earlier with changing the dynamics of what the organizations look like, right? So that came up a lot for us in our conversations and our talks and our meetings around, you know, why is my job not hiring people of color? Why is my job not keep hiring people who look like me? You know, it's fresh out of college, who doesn't really have any experience in the, or may not even have any farm experience or growing experience, but because they're, you know, these organizational heads are comfortable, right, with people who look like them, they just continue to hire these people. And people have been fired from raising these concerns at their jobs before. People have been pushed out for raising these concerns at certain urban ag organizations in the city. It was real for a lot of the folks who were at the table. And I was thankful that I was at the table with a bunch of radical people, which was awesome. You know, they were like willing to stand up and take these, you know, take these. And so what we found is that being coalesced as an organization, as a coalition, was actually giving us a little bit more power to push these organizations to do the thing. For me, because I don't work for, and because I'm not aligned with one specific organization, and I'm aligned with a law department, when I go talk to a director and I say, why doesn't your staff look like your community? Then I'm heard, right? Yeah. As opposed to just someone off the street or a staff person coming and saying the thing. So the conversations that I was having with EDs when I was meeting with folks was, okay, why does your staff look like that? Why does your board look like that? What are the things that you're doing to change that? How would you like me to help, right? If this is your mission as a food justice organization, then these are the things that you should be thinking about. Economic justice is very much tied to racial justice, and you can't think about one without understanding and acknowledging the other and participating in changing both of those, right? Mm. So people started listening, and I feel like, you know, because there were so many of us, you know, and we were coalesced, that, you know, organization heads were sort of like, okay, I got you. Together. People are looking now, right?
Yeah.
Someone is paying attention to me, right? So then I started getting job, you know, people started sending me job things when they come in, job announcements, you know, sending me. So now all of a sudden I'm the gatekeeper of these job announcements, which I hate. But, and on the other hand, I had, you know, this extensive listserv of folks that I've met and, you know, of color throughout the city who may not be connected, who aren't connected in these other ways to these organizations, and I could pass that out to them. So that started a whole another sort of, line of work for us.
Yeah,
to
you became a hub in this network.
So Soil Generation.
A network of empowerment.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. So we were this, you know, and it continues, and we've been really helpful. I mean, we're really blessed to have, like, gotten lots of people jobs and have had, you know, changed the way people are thinking about their boards. And, you know, so we're pushing the institutions in the city and within urban ag in this really awesome way. Mm. And also at the same time, we're like, and we still don't like the nonprofit industrial system. So what are we going to do about that? And so we said, let's form a cooperative. You know, why don't we show them a model of what collectivity looks like, you know, what we could actually do if we were all working together, resourcing together in a way to make sure that the community as a whole in the city is cared for, right?
And that's what Soil Generation has become.
And that's what we have become, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the work with Urban Creators. Is that a part of Soil Generation?
They are an organization.
Within Soil Generation?
Yes, within Soil Generation.
Oh, I see.
And I met them through my work here, you know, as going around meeting different orgs and different people growing food in the city. And I immediately, because they were young people, you know, like 26 at the time, you know, 25, 26, and they had taken over this huge piece of land and just like were doing amazing things there. And because they had no understanding of the nonprofit system, they had no understanding of, you know, like how they should properly, you know, quote unquote, properly do things in a nonprofit way. They were just moving like
as a force,
right? Just doing it. And I love that, you know, and I totally support young people doing this thing. Like, that's my thing. I love young people's, you know, especially teens and younger adults and their vision, right? Because their ability to dream, you know, we have that when we're young, because we have no fear when we're young, right? We gain that sort of as we get older, right? The more experiences we have, the more fearful we get. And so when folks are young, they just have no fear of, like, you know, repercussion, no fear of, like, messing up, you know, failure. It's really interesting. So they were doing things that other farms weren't doing because they had this, you know, because they were young by themselves and had vision, you know. And so other things that other farms would be like, oh, you know, the large boards that say, that dictate what they can and cannot do, and it's always within the realm of, you know, the possibilities. These guys are just like, we're going to do the impossible all the time. And so they asked me to be on their board, which is the first thing. Before they were part of Soul Generation, they were like, oh, we love you, we want you to be on our board. So that's where I started with Urban Creators. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they came into a coalition. And then as my in my role, understanding that they were having a challenging time keeping a gardener, a farm manager, I said I would do that for them. One, because I love to work in, like, I need to stay on the ground. Like, I can't just do organizing because then I get separated from the community. A lot of times you find, I didn't want to be in meetings all day downtown and not be a part of. So I've always kept a gardening job as well. So when I was volunteering at gardens, when I first started working here, I started also working what is the name of that organization? Overbrook Environmental Educational Center.
Mm.
So, and that was because I had met Jerome at that job, and he was the only black man that I knew in the city that had a thing, right? So he was a black man who had an environmental organization, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna work for you. He literally offered me a job the second week that I worked here. I was like, okay. So I took that job, and it was interesting there, it was nice knowing that I was working within a black organization and staying on the ground and staying connected to people, but I didn't have a huge community base. And so a lot of times it was just me growing food in a tunnel in a hoop house because he didn't have enough land to grow outside on the dirt. So we were growing inside in this hoop house on top of a garage, very interesting setup. But it's a demonstration garden, so it wasn't really feeding people in a way that, you know, it sort of felt like, okay, this is all for show and not necessarily for actual work. And it was weird for me a little bit. And so I wanted to be more infused in community and more community-based mm-hmm. stuff. So when the issue came there, I was still working at the Environmental Center, but I said I would finish out their season for them because their farm manager had left early. So I finished out their season. I decided I'm going to stay here. It's a lot more land. It's on the land. Yeah. I can actually do more growing and work more community-based. So I left the other job to stay there, to take that one. And so I've been there as a farm manager ever since. But I can't, you know, I'm working there, like most farm managers are there every day and all day long. So luckily I have a farm assistant who's there daily, and I just sort of give direction, put the plants in and that kind of thing. And so we work together. It's a very collectively run organization. So mm-hmm. we all sort of help out each other in our roles when it's needed. Yeah. So yeah.
This is something that I've been thinking about with the boom that's going on, the building boom in Philadelphia, and this concern about toxics and lead being particularly an issue. And I wonder about the reclaiming land, these mm-hmm. lots, these abandoned lots, right. These vacant lots. What is the process for extracting that mm-hmm. to then be able to grow food that's healthy for the community there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so the thing about soil is the thing about soil and plants is that they're amazing, right? and certain plants have the ability to remediate soil, right? And so the studies on soil and contaminants in soil and the uptake of contaminants in soil into food is very varied, actually. And one of the coolest studies I read, we did a whole soil study here through the Food Policy Council in the city, because when the city was like, okay, we're going to give leases out, they're like, what? We need to know what's up with soil because we don't want to be liable for people getting lead contamination and things. So a lot of times what farms will do, what gardens will do, is they'll build raised beds. Mm. Raised beds bring in soil, compost and soil, and just grow in those to avoid the situation with lead. All farms and gardens are told or advised to get your soil tested when you first start. You know, when you first start wherever, get it tested. It's very inexpensive. You know, it's like $5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really cheap. Yeah, you send it in through Penn State Extension or something, and they send it off to a lab, and they send you back your results. There's precautions that you take to make sure that, you know, if you use gloves, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. So, but a lot of our farms are very interested and very committed to building soil, right? So a lot of us grow directly in the soil. We're using wood chips, we're using cardboard mulching, we're using different mulching methods that help repair and planting specific plants to help remediate the soil. So we had a young woman came out last year, one of the scientists I know, with a little science soil gun, which is really cool. They have these laser guns now that can just and it just like gives you soil readings.
Whoa.
And she said this was like the farm at the Urban Creatives was like the soil at Urban Creatives was like some of the best soil she's tested in the city. She's like ever, like since she's been testing soil in the city, she's never had soil that like that was that clean or whatever. I don't know really what that means because I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
Like she is, but I was like, okay, because we actively, you know, we just build wood chips compost, newspaper, cardboard, wood chips compost. And over the years, it's been 7 years now, right? We've built up, and that site was a dump site for years, right? Mm-hmm. It was an old industrial building years and years ago. It wasn't as bad. It's not, you know, a super fun site where it's not a brownfield, right? Where mm-hmm. it was like really everything was destroyed. It was just an industrial site. So, you know, there's a lot of chances that there was all kinds of things in the soil before, right? Mm-hmm. Including pipes and, you know, all kinds of things under there. And things pop up still, you know, that's how it is with the earth. A lot of farms are actively building soil because we know that we can, right? And that the work that we, you know, that we're doing is helping that in the way that's really, really important for the cities with regards to climate, because it allows us to have, to filter groundwater in a way that is not happening around the city. So, you know, the big thing in the city with global, you know, global warming is, it's groundwater, right? You know, not having
the increased precipitation.
Yeah, because we have so much concrete. You know, we get charged now a stormwater runoff fee, right? And you get charged a stormwater runoff fee because you live in a city with a lot of concrete, and that concrete is not allowing the rain that comes down to go back into our groundwater system. It washes off, goes into our rivers and our lakes, and it's not getting into our groundwater, which is where we source that drinking water from, right? Mm-hmm. So gardens and not just gardens with not just green space, because green space with grass is a very different experience than when we have plants that have roots, that have deep roots that allow the water to go back into the groundwater source. And so when rain comes down in gardens, it is filtered and goes right back into our groundwater sources, which is very helpful for the cities with regards to flooding, which is why you see now the water department has lots of rain gardens all over the city, mm-hmm. because they are acknowledging that actually plants help the situation with climate change in the city.
That's
in
great.
These ways, as well as like cooling down too, right? So we have, you know, we have more trees and berry bushes and things that are cooling down the systems as we are, you know, heating up in our cities. We have these, you know, when we have these green spaces are allowing us to, you know, cool down. And so there's a lot of different ways that urban agriculture is contributing to the sustainability of our cities, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's always like, why is the city not realizing that and as a whole, right? Because the water department is. But these guys, but they're not, they're like low guys on the totem pole and they don't get to council. It's really funny to watch the whole dynamics. But, you know, but the folks who are in power are still reticent to, like, you know, accept the fact that these are really necessary. They're going to be way more necessary moving forward mm-hmm. with climate change the way that it is than they are even now, right? Understanding that these green spaces allow us, afford us a lot of different ways to sustain the systems that we currently have, right? Even though
Great.
We would like those to change,
yeah.
Ones that we have.
This sounds like a good opportunity for us to transition into
That's
our
right.
future visioning
mm-hmm.
part. I'd like to start off by asking kind of some abstract questions, and then we'll just kind of move into visioning piece
okay.
of it. Does that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything before we move into the future that you want to talk about from the past that we haven't covered?
I don't care. I think of any right now.
Well, the first question I would ask that's sort of an abstract transition is, what are some of the things that you value most, that you love most?
Mm-hmm. People. Land.
Mm-hmm.
Love. That's pretty much it.
Love it. What are some of the things that scare you most, that you fear most?
Injustice and the manifestations of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much it.
What are some things that you would be willing to fight for?
Things that I do fight for.
Yeah.
Still, right? Or currently. Fight for our right to exist, right? In a way that's meaningful. And so, whatever that looks like. But yeah, I'm willing to fight for our right to live meaningful every day. That's what I'm doing. Yeah.
What are some of the things that make you most hopeful?
Children make me most hopeful, and seeing their response to the natural world around them. It's like, yeah, we'll be okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love it. When you think of the word energy, that's kind of an abstract word itself in some way. What comes to mind when you think of energy?
When I think of energy, I think of everything, actually. So I think of the fact that energy is around us consistently. Everything that we know of is created and you know, by energy. So I think of how large the concept of energy is, and how we sort of narrow it down and think about, like, you know, how do we get our appliances to work, right? Such a small aspect of what energy is to us. So yeah, I think of everything when I think about energy.
Yeah, what isn't energy?
What isn't energy? Right.
Well, let's think a little bit about Philadelphia's energy future. Right now, there's for the future visioning piece, you can go in all these different extremes, business as usual, and sort of a dystopic sort of tale that might happen that way. There's the utopian sort of side that can be all of the dreams, all of our wishes coming true, whatever that might be. And there's maybe a hybrid somewhere in there. So however you want to imagine these futures, these are your futures to dream with. If we're going to launch 50 years into the future, into the year 2067, what does Philly feel like? What does life in Philly feel like? And how is energy a part of life in that 50 years from that future?
Mm-hmm. All right, so 50 years in the past was?
50 years in the past was 1967.
All right.
Oil was the king energy source. Philadelphia was in the midst of a transition. The nation itself was in a transition. Culturally, socially, economically, issues of gender were just kind of emerging in a lot of contexts as far as power is concerned. The environmental movement was really kind of just sort of moving forward in a different way at that time. And absolutely black identity and black consciousness was continuing to expand at an even broader and bigger rate. So that was 50 years in the past.
Mm-hmm.
50 years in the future, in the year 2067.
Right, 50 years in the future.
Talk to me about Philadelphia.
So 50 years in the future for me would probably look like a hybrid situation happening with us trying to get off of fossil fuels, right? I understand, for me, I feel like that's inevitable, right? So inevitably we have to be off of fossil fuels. It's like drugs, right? We have to get off of fossil fuels. And so 50 years in the future, we are transitioning between those two, between letting go of the fossil fuels and accepting more of the renewable energy sources that we know we can achieve, right, that we have access to, that we have ways to create, which for me is understandably, there we have the science of how to harness energy and have had it for over 100 years and how to do so in a way that's free. So the next 50 years we're going to be tricked. It's going to be them trying to figure out how to utilize that, to take that information and put a value to it so that people can't get it for free, right? So that, how do we, you know, sort of like the marijuana thing, right? Like, how do we regulate this in a way that that only certain people have access to the creation of it, and folks who want it have to pay to get it. So it's really the next 50 years trying to create the system of ushering in new renewable energy, right?
That'll be the existing power forces trying to value that, create a valuation on that, to then sell it?
Yes. That's where we would be, so in the middle of that. So it would be pretty chaotic. It's going to be pretty chaotic in 50 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What does Philly look like in 50 years? Is it much different from today? Are people moving around in different ways?
Yeah. I think it is much different. It's much wider than it is now. It's a lot more crowded. So in my head, it's more like Hong Kong, right? So, you know, there's a lot more people here, a lot more white folks here.
Why more white folks?
Because that's a trend.
For the city.
Yeah, that's the trend. That's what's happening now. Folks are coming back, you know. White folks are reclaiming land that they maybe their parents had years ago and that kind of thing. I mean, the whole gentrification thing is based on, you know, young millennials wanting to come back to the city, but also on our elder folks who want to be closer to the resources that they need, right? Who have maybe moved out to rural space, urban or suburban spaces, and where they were driving, and now they don't want to drive so much, and it's just more convenient, right? So the convenience of the city, having things close to you, resources close to you that you need, is appealing to a lot of people right now. So it's gonna, and also that's what the push is, right? So the larger push you know, nationally, I mean, internationally, is to get folks into these urban centers, right? We're hearing all about the super urban centers that are going to happen. And that's based on the fact that all the needs, all the resources are going to be in these cities, right? And in these huge hubs or whatever. So I think it's going to be a lot more crowded and a lot more white folks. That's what it looks like to me. What I think is going to, competitively, energy is going to be hugely competitive. There'll be a whole lot more players on the scene, right? Because we're talking about, because now we have renewable energy folks that are coming into, and folks who were so adamant to stay with fossil fuels are going to be trying to catch up to the folks who already have this. And so that those folks, those companies will be growing, right, and getting more money, and then probably changing, unfortunately, the way that this thing goes, and then probably changing their values based on economic trends, right? And so it may not be so much that they're green, the companies that are right now, like really about this renewable energy, because they think it's the right thing. Once profits start rolling in, it's going to be very much more about money than it is about the green thing, the sustainability. And so they're going to change and be a lot more greedy, right, than they are now, because they're just like fish, small fish now, right? Mm-hmm. When they start getting a taste of what can be, they're going to want more. And so we're going to have a lot more greedy guzzlers trying to get, you know, renewable energy versus oh, sort of like the soda tax thing, where you have these huge soda companies who align themselves with community groups to say, we don't want the sugar tax. It's weird because it serves all purposes. I see that for the energy sources in 50 years. Mm. That's what 50 years
is. In 50 years, what's the food movement that you're building here now? What's it look like in 50 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's a big part of energy, too.
Yes.
Where are people getting their energy to move?
Yes.
Right? It's their food.
So I see small groups of, So village style, small groups of land trusts within the city that are caring and stewarding land in a way that is helping to sustain the larger systems, right? As a lot of the time, that's sort of the only, like, we hear and we know about these big things, right? Or these big institutions, but the smaller ones are the ones that sort of comprise and make up the what's really happening on the ground, right? Which is, and so I think that's going to continue in the future, and that so we'll have little pockets of land trusts where people are stewarding land in a very thoughtful way and practicing very thoughtful ways of being together on the land in urban spaces.
So more like a neighborhood cooperatives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I say community land trust because this way those folks own and have a stake in the land and where they live. And staying in these cities and helping them to sustain themselves. Because, I mean, for me, I would think that we would all roll out of the city and go live in some rural spaces. But people are really committed to, like, you know, the idea of living, you know, these urban lifestyles. So for those who are committed to living earth style and also committed to the earth, they're going to create their own little small meccas, right? Of earthliness within the city. So there'll be little small groups of banded groups of earth workers.
I love it. Let's move forward and jump to about 123 years. We're looking at the year 2140, so almost 125 years in the future. As a reference point, if we step back in time, 123 years in the past was the year 1894. So this was when Milton Hershey is founding his first chocolate company. Thomas Edison had just built the world's first ever coal-fired electricity plant in New York. And coal had just, in the United States particularly, just overtaken wood as a dominant energy source. This is really before the age of oil as a means of transportation and energy, electricity generation. So that was 123 years in the past. Interested in what 2140 in the future looks like. Long-term, scientists, of course, are anticipating all sorts of climatic effects that could destabilize governments, increase waves of refugees. The precipitation of this area in particular in Philadelphia is expected to rise, as you mentioned, and some of the neighborhoods around our tidal rivers could be inundated and slightly flooded.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also potential of a collapse of agriculture as a result of the climatic changes and whether plants can adapt fast enough and whether genetic modifications to those plants could be implemented. So there's a lot of questions about what the year 2140 could be like. It's 125 years from now.
Yeah.
What's your vision for Philadelphia in the year 2140?
Right. Yeah, so 2140 is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's changed. Buildings have changed, right? We don't have the same energy needs as before. Let's say that in 125 years, those folks who have been working under sort of below the radar on different types of energy sourcing have had time to like really put together, you know, the understandings of these, how the workings of energy in our spaces, and how we can harness energy in different ways. And so,
what are some of those ways that you're picturing?
Right. So one of the ways I'm picturing it is from life, right? So like I feel like, you know, that we will be able, we're looking towards how we can harness our personal, you know, our bodily energy so I should be walking down the street and my iPhone is played because it's linked into my system somehow, right, into my body somewhere, and so I am generating the energy that's necessary for my iPod to run, right, as I jog or as I, you know what I mean, or as I'm just walking down the street. So I feel like there'll be a whole lot more ways that people have been able to explore energy sourcing, right? So I don't see big, because it's 125 years later, I definitely see government like almost non-existent, right? Or very chaotic, right? Mm. And so not serving the community in a way, them not serving community in a certain way over so much time, people have stopped, you know, sort of buying into government and have created their own little societies, right? And so there's these smaller societies that are ruling, you know, that are creating their own ways of sustaining themselves based on their resources. And so you will have some folks who are really innovative. You have some folks, you know, money folks, who will still be reliant on those large systems to keep them afloat, because that's what they know, right? And those folks who are more innovative will be now. So like the shift, 100. So we were at the 50-year mark. 50 years from then, you know, there were, you know, everything was sort of still as it was, but now 120 years later, you know, folks are separated. There's not so much the thems and the us. There's a whole lot of smaller groups of what are they, affinity groups of folks coming together and supporting themselves in specific ways, because they know they have to, because the government isn't serving them. It's been long enough. Folks know this is not the case, and so they've started to create their own systems among themselves. So we have smaller systems that are interplaying with each other, and folks are working together collaboratively to figure out their energy, how to get their energy needs sourced, right? Agriculture and the needs for agriculture, I feel like those folks who were 50 years, who were 70 years before that, who were, you know, in these smaller stewarding land in certain ways, it would be a lot more influential in showing and growing and showing and sharing that knowledge with other people who are understanding a little bit more now. But okay, these guys might have an answer, because where the rest of us are standing in 3 inches of water, these guys over here have this whole water filtration system that is allowing them to exist in a certain way. So how do we do that too? So then you see that the folks who are just stewarding land and living in a certain way start to be the leaders and the thinkers for the how do we break this out. And so those folks now, 120 years later, are so that's sort of the turnaround, right? So now those folks who had to be most resilient, right, because they had the least resources, because they've built up their resilience and built up their understanding and knowledge base due to their having to be resilient, are now the folks who are leading the thing because they know best how to do the thing. And so energy is being sourced and varies in various ways, because we understand that the silos and big things big systems never worked for us. So we are valuing smaller systems, and so there's a lot of small ways that we're sourcing our energy, varied, diverse ways of sourcing energy, not just one big system of coal or one big system of, you know, so yeah, there's a whole lot of...
What do buildings look like? What's it look like to walk, what does it feel like to walk throughout the streets of Philadelphia?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the streets are spongy and I feel like the streets are spongy and not really, the cement is cracked up and earth has seeped in. And because the water is so present everywhere and not being able to go back, that it has created, you know, sort of like this marshy, almost slimy, right? You know how you see leftover, like algae sort of like streets. And so, yeah, it's really almost Jurassic, but not, because you still have these large constructions, these large buildings that you know, that served a purpose at one time, right? So like North Philly now, right, you have this old industrial buildings down there, right? That, and the turn of the century, you know, they were live and flourishing. Now they're just like broken windows and big giant, mm-hmm. you know, those now have, you know, grass and everything. Vines have grown all over everything.
Nature has reclaimed
this. Nature is reclaiming the place to a certain way, most definitely. And then what's happening now is that you don't have these large meccas. We're all the people. And I think that a lot of people are going to be gone. So I think that, you know, that
Philly's population will have shrunk.
Yeah. I think that a lot of populations are shrunk. Uh-huh, across the world, due to climate change,
and that
a lot of people are going to die, right? Mm. A lot of us aren't going to make it because of this. So the varying, you know, situations that we have with the weather and the land as a response to that, people are going to die. So it'll be a smaller population.
How are those people that are living in Philly? How are they moving around? How are they getting around?
Of course, back just me.
I like that vision.
We all got horses. So maybe some horsebacks. I think that, you know, I think about where, you know, the future of cars, man. I just have no idea where that's going to go, right? I just, you know, I think about the Fifth Element often. You know, Bruce Willis and these flying contraptions and, you know, these little tiny parking garages. And I'm like, oh, my God, please don't let that be our future. And at the same time, recognizing that it absolutely could be, right? So in my future, we're not so technical. It's not so technical because technology started to, at some point, and we'll go on to that in the 300s. So technology at some point is starting to coexist with the environment and understanding how they can work together collaboratively in ways that are not so demanding of the earth, right? Because the folks who are doing, the techie folks are understanding that, you know, that they have also a role in trying to save us here, you know, to allow humans to still exist on this planet, right? Mm-hmm. When I say save us, I mean as humans, because I don't think the Earth is going anywhere. We're not killing the Earth. We're killing our ability to live on the Earth. And so, you know, and so hopefully folks are, you know, being more politicized, right? Through their actions of technology, and now technology is serving the environment in a better way, right? I don't know what cars will look like. Yeah. In that sense, I don't know if we'll be having cars.
Well, let's think even further, because you're mentioned, you already, I can see you're starting to creep into thinking about what that 300 year mark looks like. So if we launch the year 2312, that's 295 years in the future, as a reference point for us to step back from today, 295 years ago was the year 1722. Right, so North America was dominated by Native American cultures across most of the continent. There were some pretty strong white colonization practices happening along the coast, and some battles and a lot of disease being moved because of that. But Philadelphia as a city did exist. It was 40 years old at that point. But the revolution that began in Philadelphia or was the political hub for it was another half century into the future. So it's a pretty long time ago. The dominant energy sources by far were wood, along with food and plants that were fed to people or to animals, and then their muscle power is what created most of the energy, along with burning wood and water. So if we're going to step forward, not 150 years, but twice that, 300 years into the future from today, into the year 2312, What's Philly like?
Yeah. So Philly is... So
this Philly here?
This Philly here.
Yeah.
So I think that we are going to be growing food and growing food indoors in some ways. Sort of like those, not just indoors, so also, right? In order to supply what we need agriculturally, we would have to have created... but much more highly intensely grown food ways, which will require us to do more vertical growing. Mm. And so you see large paths of, you know, food growing vertically in these really constructive, you know, interesting ways.
So buildings that are basically farms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that the that used to be buildings. People can't dwell. The dwellings that used to be but their materials haven't broken down yet. They're still being used, and so they're being used and repurposed in this other way, right, to help to grow food. Technically, we've advanced to the point where we are utilizing our body system. So that's what I was saying before. So we are traveling by our own means. We're able to travel around the city with a thought in some ways, shielding ourselves or creating or utilizing this body as a machine, right? And in a way that's really moving us around the city. Mm. So like you see those little skateboards, so like a skateboard, but you just want your thing. So we don't really need cars anymore. So cars are a thing of the past because we understand that this body we have can be manufactured to create, to travel in these other ways. So we're traveling, you know, with our bodies around to the places that we need to get to and to see the people that we need to see. Our energy sources are still varied, right? We have still a huge amount of different ways that we collect energy to enact the things that we need to do. So we are never again going to be just resourcing one energy. So we have understood that our energy needs have to be met by a diverse system of.
What are some of those different ways you have in mind?
Right. Water, right? So water is going to be hugely present, right? So there'll be, again, you know, we're 300 years in the future, so there's less people because there's less livable land, right? Land that people can actually live on and resource. And so let's hope that Philadelphia is still here. But I feel like the way that Philadelphia is positioned on the oceanic, like in the geographically, that this will still exist, most definitely. Not as large as it is, not as large as a city as it is. We'll lose some, you know, we're going to have a lot, we have lost some feet, you know, maybe a mile in or something like that. But we will still stand, luckily, because we're like not on the ocean's edge, but on the river edge. And so, and also because we're sourced between three rivers, right? So we do have this, you know, this access to fresh water, which is going to bring more people probably down to our area. But on a smaller, but still because there's less people in the world altogether, mm-hmm. it's not as many as was when it was 50 years later, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. at the height of, I think like 50 years from now, it will be like the height of what the population density will be in the city here. Mm-hmm. In 300 years from now, it'll be lessened. Of course, but a lot, lessons from a lot, but then also folks from around, right, who are coming into the city to get their resources, certain needs.
So just so I can follow that, the population will peak in 50, from now, mm-hmm. in 50 years, mm-hmm. and then in 120, 125 years, it'll drop, mm-hmm. because they'll be dealing with all these climate effects,
yeah.
But in 300 years, mm-hmm. the population will rise again, but mm-hmm. not quite to that, the crazy levels
but
that it'll
to
be.
The level from, yes.
I love
exactly.
it. Okay, I love this vision.
So our energy needs are being met from all different, you know, from all and thoughtfully, right? So, but you also have greed. I don't think that greed is going to always be in a picture.
Less greed.
I said yes, there will be less greed. Greed will always be in the picture, but hopefully less greed.
What do you picture in place? Like, what are the politics and the way that Philadelphians are interacting with each other?
Right. So hopefully I'm hopeful that 300 years from now, I'm not hopeful that the race situation is figured out. I'm hopeful that the poverty situation is figured out where we have a lot more, a better understanding of what poverty, what was driving poverty. And since that, those systems have been, those systems have been destroyed. when the rebuilding of, right, required those folks who are most oppressed, who are now the knowledge holders, right? And those folks have chosen to exist and to organize in a different way, right? In a way that's not so oppressive of others, right? We're not recreating what was done to us, but allowing something new to unfold. And so in doing so, there is a lot of opposition. So there's like insurgent groups of like folks who don't want to give up power from the past, who are like, you know, doing all these really cruel things to, you know, so you have to have some kind of defense. And that defense in 300 years is not going to look like what it looks like now with these really cruel and crude, in ways of destroying people. But these really awesome ways of generating and manifesting energy to protect ourselves and our communities. So you might see large green domes that that encapsulates, you know, just the urban spaces where people are dwelling to keep out, you know, negative forces who would come in to destroy us. So we have, you know, understanding energy in a way and being able to harness energy in a certain way to protect ourselves from outside harm. So we would have force fields and things like that that allows us to not, you know, be totally inundated from, you know, other folks who are trying to get to the sources of the things.
Yeah. So one of the things that I heard is the poverty issue will have been solved, or at least moving towards solution in terms of equity. But you said that the race issue would still be present.
Yeah.
Talk to me about why you think that's happened in 300 years.
Yeah. I think that I had a friend years ago, and she said to me, you know, when we look at ourselves as energy beings and understand ourselves to be, you know, to be able to be, create sort of, as creators, we could manifest lots of things if we didn't have fears and different blockages keeping us from doing that, and lots of different things, lots of maybe the ways that we eat food, you know, all these different things that sort of keep us from toning into our real, to the potential of the power that we have within these bodies, right, these shells. And so we were talking about race and how sort of race evolved, right? You know, understanding that as civilization started in what we know now as Africa, right? And so everyone sort of moved from that space around the globe. And so why do we even have these different colors and these different, you know, shades of what we are? It's very much related to our environments and where we ended up being, where our folks laid down roots and contributed to. And then so our conversation was around, like, so but why now, you know, still 2,000 years later, are we still holding these colors, even though our environments and our situations have changed? And she said to me, it was just such a simple response, and it's so weird that I just never thought about that before. She said, because we want to. And so understanding that this is psychological, that racism is not just, you know, was a social construct, but now is being held as a psychological construct, how we move past that, I think it's going to take a little bit longer. Then, you know, we've been out of slavery, but slavery happened 500 years ago, right? It began around 500 years ago. And we are still in the midst of figuring this shit out. So I don't think at all that 300 years from now we'll have that figured out. I don't. I think we'll still be dealing with the race issue. And I mean, 300 years from now, you know, there might be all kinds of different races down here. We can have all kinds of different beings, sentient beings that are, you know, that are living, you know, side by side with us. And we might have energy sources and information that we've never had before based on alien technology and alien influence that we've been pretending that it's not there, and allowing that to be a part of our society and acknowledging that, you know, I would imagine that I have no idea what 300 years is going to look like, because I expect to have, and I expect the alien influence to be way more present than it, and accepted and understood and acknowledged than it is now, right? And that will unlock and open up this opportunity for us to experience and experiment with lots of different ways of being that we haven't in the past, because we've been trying to control the narrative of what is actually out there.
I love it. Is there anything else that you want to share in terms of your vision of Philadelphia and its future, what you hope for, what you're concerned about, what you would love to see happen?
Yeah, I think that I dream about the future, and I play in the future in the concept of the realm, you know, sort of future, because I can, and because, you know, it's fun. And at the same time, I recognize and acknowledge that I believe that this is a design. That there's a perfect design to the way things move within the, you know, and the universe, actually, and that that just our soul, things that are happening here on Earth, and it's a very small part of the changes that we experience here on Earth. That there's this whole universal system that is also contributing to the changes that are happening here. So because we don't acknowledge that, and we don't really have a deep understanding of what is going on universally in our cosmos, we can't. We haven't been able to implement that and sort of put that in a place here on our daily lives in order to understand its influence on us in the future, right? So I see the future as whatever it should be, right? When that future comes around, and understanding that this is a perfect design, or just not perfect design, but just a design, right? And that things fall and follow patterns in the way that it was created. Yeah.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Roger.
Yeah.
This was fun.